All right, the other day we talked about DNA structure, and we whipped through it pretty quickly, and part of that is I have student teachers that either are in my lab or help me out. Actually, the UTA is a student teacher, and then they tell me, well, they get DNA structure once in junior high, once in high school, and they've already had it in 197 or the equivalent. So, you know, at this point, you've seen DNA structure a few times. If you can't figure out what the complementary base pairs are, it should take you about a minute to look that up and commit it to memory. That's the word I'm looking for. We'll talk a little bit more about some of the coiling nature of DNA. Today, we're going to talk about DNA doesn't exist as a naked molecule in functional cells. And I mentioned the other day that one of the things that drives me nuts about textbook is when we talk about DNA-protein interactions, DNA is always stretched out, and it's always bound by a pastel oval protein or a circle. DNA forms a lot of secondary structures that need to form, but then later when we start talking about gene expression, we have to undo all this stuff. So the first thing we'll talk about is supercoiling, right? And we're going to be talking the first part of the class today on compaction of DNA. With both prokaryotes and eukaryotes, if we just let the DNA relax, the DNA itself is much larger than the cell in which it resides. So we've got to fold up DNA, we've got to twist it around, we've got to do a bunch of different stuff to squeeze it inside of a cell that is trying to be a minimal size. So prokaryotes and eukaryotes have the same problem, but one of the common themes that you'll see in the next 9 or 10 weeks in here is that they go about solving problems in different ways. So supercoiling is the tendency of particularly prokaryotes, but eukaryotes do this, but this is a major, major mechanism for prokaryotes, for bacteria, and that is to either remove some twists or add some twists to the DNA. So what happens is they'll nick one strand of the double-stranded molecule, they'll grab it, and then they'll just start either unwinding it or winding it tighter. Okay. Now, in a typical DNA molecule, this is one helical turn. So if we look at this one's going around, coming back here, and it comes back to the same starting point. So this is one helical turn. That's 10 base pairs for one helical turn. Okay. So if you nick this DNA and you start twisting it so that you're adding turns to it, that means the number of base pairs per turn will decrease. Okay? Because you're putting torsion on there, you're actually making that helical turn in fewer base pairs, and that's referred to as positive supercoiling. And you can do the other way. You can induce supercoiling by removing turns, unwinding it because this is its stable state, so to get back to something like this, it will start lumping up. So you can get negative supercoiling. And that's more base pairs per turn. Okay. The thing is, the base pairs are what you have to look at when you're trying to determine if something's supercoiled, positively supercoiled, or negatively supercoiled. It used to be really easy to explain the concept of supercoiling when I first started lecturing because essentially all phones had cords. And you guys have spent the vast majority of your life dealing with phones that do not have cords. You've never had the problem of what happens when these things get all hinked up. But that's essentially supercoiling. And so here's an example showing a circular chromosome in a bacterium. And it's much like a phone cord that's hanging down here. Here we're over-rotating by two turns. Here we're under-rotating. And what happens is each helical turn that's either added or removed, the enzyme that does that is topoisomerase. Sorry. Topoisomerase introduces or removes torsion on the DNA molecule. And for each helical turn that you either over-rotate or under-rotate, you will get a crossing event of the circular DNA. Okay? So what happens is if we pick up this receiver and we twist it around a couple of times and then we put it back on the hook, that we've supercoiled the phone cord and it will cause the phone cord to crisscross a couple of times. Because the phone cord has this preferred relaxed state that it's in, and when we start introducing extra torsion to it, to compensate for that, it's a flexible structure, it will supercoil, it will crisscross, kind of knot up. If you take a circular rubber band and start twisting on it, you know how it knots up on itself and it goes from being a circle to this small clumpy thing? That's what's happening with supercoiling, that the strands are separated, topoisomerase either introduces or removes helical turns. Oh, here's a bigger picture. This is a phone cord, kids. Back in the old days, you actually had to dial in a circle, too, and you hated if your friends had a lot of nines in their number. All right, so when I was telling you about focusing on the base pairs, this is what you have to do, because if you look at this and the question is, a DNA molecule has 300 base pairs and it's got 20 complete rotations. Is this positively supercoiled, negatively supercoiled, or is this the normal relaxed configuration? All right, the normal relaxed is the 10 base pairs per helical turn. So we don't have that. Okay. But if you start with the 20 helical turns, okay, and if you say, well, there are 20 helical turns, there should be 200 base pairs, there are too many base pairs per helical turn, you would say that it's negatively supercoiled. Okay. But if you approach it from 300 base pairs long, if it's 300 base pairs long, you would say it's positively supercoiled. If it's 20, it should have 200. It's got 300, that there are more than you'd expect. But if it's 300 base pairs, it should be 30 helical turns. And so there would be fewer. So keep in mind that it's the base pairs we're looking at. It's not the helical turns. Not enough or too many helical turns. It's the number of base pairs that you focus on. So 300 base pairs, you'd expect 30. We don't have the 30 helical turns. Okay, so lock in on the base pairs first and use that as your fixed thing. Okay. All right, so this is just a picture. We've seen this before of an exploded DNA cell, or of a bacterial cell with its DNA coming out. But one of the things that happens on top of supercoiling will introduce loops and twists in the chromosome, but there are also proteins that will bind to the DNA and bunch these loops together. Okay? And they're referred to as histone-like proteins. When we talk about eukaryotes, we'll talk about true histone proteins, but in bacteria, these are referred to as histone-like. And they form at the bottom of these loops. And so they will stabilize the bottoms of these loops. And then these proteins have an affinity for each other. They will tend to clump together to bring the bases of those loops of DNA close together and keep them from spreading back out. So if you look here, we can see some of these loops going out, but you can find junction points where several of them originate, and then they're connected down here. Here's one where you can see several coming off from a branch point. It's where the proteins aggregate and sort of tie it together. But hopefully you gain an appreciation of how much DNA is inside of a cell compared to the size of the cell. So this process of compaction is essential. Much of the supercoiling has been taken out of this DNA molecule, so it's taking up a lot more space outside of the cell than it was inside the cell. Okay, so supercoiling and histone-like proteins are the keys for prokaryotes. Eukaryotes have much more DNA inside of them. The cells are larger, but there's orders of magnitude more DNA inside of them. You have well over 1,000 times more DNA than the bacterium that I work with. And so when we have protein interacting with DNA, we refer to that as chromatin. And so I mentioned DNA just doesn't exist as a naked molecule inside of a functional cell. It always has proteins associated with it, and that protein DNA complex is referred to as chromatin. And we've got a few flavors of chromatin that are present based on, they've got some overt differences, but euchromatin, okay, if you remember way back, when I told you that U, E-U means true, so this is true chromatin, but euchromatin has DNA that will be transcribed or expressed. Okay. So here's the problem if you're a cell, that you've got more DNA than you need. Okay, you've over time eukaryotes have gotten really big and complex genomes, but the cell size of eukaryotes hasn't varied that much. Right, so the amount of compaction that has to take place is fairly significant. Okay. So now you wind up your DNA, you attach it to proteins, you do all this stuff, but ultimately you need to access that DNA to get the biological information that's stored within it. And that's what I mean when I talk about it's transcribed or expressed, that the biological information contained in the genes in that region of DNA have to be accessed, and they can't be accessed in a highly compacted fashion. So, you know, sorry, I'm doing old guy technology analogies again today. Way back when, before we had high-speed transmission of data, it was very common that if you had files that you were sending to somebody, that you always compacted them. Now you occasionally get a zip file, but for the most part, you can move regular-sized files easily. But back in the old days, pretty much every file that you had to send had to be compacted. And so when you get a compacted file, you just couldn't open it. You would have to decompress it before you could access that information. That's what happens with DNA. We're going to be assembling these structures to compact them, but if we want to utilize that information, we've got to disassemble these complexes. Okay? And so euchromatin tends to be regions of DNA in which that takes place. And so the level of compaction tends not to be as severe in euchromatin, that it's still wrapped up and bound, but it's a little bit more easy to access than the other flavor, which is heterochromatin. Okay. And heterochromatin is compacted all the time. And regions where you would typically find heterochromatin, they're scattered throughout the genome, but there's an abundance of them near the telomeres and near the centromere. That the DNA in those regions is largely just structural and it's not informative. So you need something at the end, you need something in the middle for the kinetochore to format. You don't express those genes, so it's heterochromatin. So heterochromatin is compacted all the time, and you actually tend to get a stronger compaction in those regions since it doesn't need to be accessed. Okay? And then one of the main ways in which we're going to compact them is through histone proteins. Okay? Histone proteins, that there are several of them. We're not going to talk about them individually much in here. If you get to MolBio, that you can talk more about the interactions with histones. What I want you to know about histones is they are positively charged proteins. Okay? DNA, the A stands for acid, which means it's a proton donor in an aqueous environment. So DNA is losing protons when it's in solution, which means that the remaining molecule will have a negative charge on it. So DNA has negative charge. Histones are positively charged, so histones will be attracted to DNA, and it will bind to DNA due to that charge. Okay. So here are the histone proteins. One, we've got two H2s, three and four. They just have their molecular mass, but we're talking about multiple proteins that are involved in this, and they all are labeled H, letting you know that they're a histone protein. And they form specific structures. So the first level of organization that we'll talk about is a nucleosome. Okay. And so here we've got, here's the double helix of DNA, and we've got histone protein. And histones tend to form, actually this is looks a little bit more spherical than they actually are. Histone proteins are shaped kind of like a barrel, that they're tapered at the ends, but they're sort of rounded in the middle. So when they aggregate, they form a barrel-like structure. And the DNA makes a little bit over two rotations around the histone. And if the example that would be if you've got rope. If we think about the DNA being like rope, that we want to shorten the amount of space. We don't want, you know, 1,000 foot of rope just laying around our basement or our garage. So we take a reel of some kind and we just start wrapping the rope around the reel. It takes up less space. That's what's happening with this first level of organization, a nucleosome. We're simply wrapping the DNA around the histones, and that happens multiple times. There's a short stretch of unassociated DNA. So it's referred to as a gap or a linker. But this DNA is not associated with histones at all. Okay. But then you basically get this, I think your book calls it a string of pearls, okay, where you get these spherical or barrel-shaped histones that have DNA wrapped around them. They've got short gaps between them. It sort of looks like a necklace at that point with beads on it. Then, so the barrel-shaped thing is made up of 2, 3, and 4. Histone H1 is the connector, and it does a couple of roles. So you can see it here on the outside. The first thing it does is it basically clamps down the DNA from the outside to the histones, or to the other histones. Okay? So it's just not now this association of the positive histones with the negative DNA. Now we've got this locking bar that comes down and holds it into place. That's H1. Okay? And then H1 has an affinity for itself. So all of these H1 proteins will be attracted to each other. So now we sort of take out the space that's created by these gaps or linkers. Instead of having gaps in between our beads, we're going to pull them together. Okay, once we get H1 on there, the H1 gets drawn together, and then we just get a cluster of the histones that have DNA around them. So before the histones, we had a really long linear structure that goes back and forth. We wrapped it around the barrels, got this one, and now we're lumping the barrels up and we get this cluster. So we've taken something that was this long, and now we've put it in this discrete space. Okay. And so that's the level of nucleosomes, is when we've got the DNA around the histone cluster. And then once you start lumping the clusters together, that's when we start talking about the chromosome structure. And you get all of those attached to each other. And then there are other enzymes that start taking all of this really lumpy fibrous material and making loops of it. So remember, in prokaryotes, we're just making loops of the DNA. Okay? Because it's got about 1/1000th of the DNA that you have. So it could just loop the naked DNA out, and that's saving enough space. In a eukaryotic cell, it doesn't loop the DNA first. It forms it into nucleosomes, and then it starts looping the nucleosomes. So it's already highly compacted before we start looping in a eukaryote. So you start getting all these loops, and the loops are stabilized by other proteins that come in, and then you start getting this thick, fibrous molecule. When we look at, in cell division, when we were looking at the slides in cell division during prophase, early prophase, you could kind of see really fibrous strands of the chromosomes, but they weren't highly compacted yet. That's basically what we're looking at in this state with the looping. But there are enzymes that make it more and more compact, and as we get closer to mid to late prophase, the chromosomes are highly condensed into these really discrete structures that when we have been drawing chromosomes, we've been drawing these highly condensed structures. But most of the time, it exists in this sort of, you know, nucleosomes that have been compacted and looped. Okay? So there's a lot of stuff going on. And remember, for all of this stuff that's going on, when we start talking about gene expression, we have to undo it. So we've got to decouple the histones at H1. We have to unwind the DNA from the histone proteins. We've got to get access to just the naked DNA when we want to access that information. So it's great to be able to pack light, but we've got to get around that in a few lectures' time. And in extreme circumstances, you can actually see, if you're looking at a chromosome, you can see an area in which the compaction has been taken out. And those are referred to as chromosomal puffs. So here we've got a chromosome, and then we've got this region where it just doesn't look as tight. If this was a sweater, it would be it looks like a pill on a sweater when the threads start to fray and come loose. That's what a chromosomal puff looks like. And it's because there are genes in this region that are being highly expressed. And we need access to that DNA on a fairly frequent basis. And so all of that compaction has been undone, and as a result, the DNA is sticking out from the adjacent areas that are still compacted. So this DNA is compacted, this DNA is compacted, and the puff is just a region of the chromosome that's highly expressed. So you can see it when it's not compacted. Right? And any time that you see a chromosomal puff, as a scientist, you know that that's an interesting part of the chromosome because there are genes on there that are required at a fairly frequent basis, so you've got typically some important genes that are present in chromosomal puffs. Okay. Now we'll get to this when we talk about transcription, that particular slide, sorry. But one of the things that you can do to determine frequently transcribed or expressed regions of the chromosome, there are some enzymes that will break down DNA if it's in a loose form but not in a compacted form, and there are actually a few enzymes that could break down compacted DNA but not loose DNA. And so scientists have the ability to go in and take a chromosome at certain times in the cell's life, subject it to these enzymes, and see the difference in sensitivity. And that difference in sensitivity, they develop a profile then determining whether what stretches of DNA exist in a relaxed form at certain times in the cell. So then you can get a neighborhood. Oh, the genes on this part of the chromosome are expressed frequently because they're puffed often. So it's a good starting point for scientists to look at genes. And if you're interested in developmental biology, you know, if you're trying to figure out like how eyes form in the zebrafish, and a lot of eye formation happens like day 3 through 6, you can go in and look at chromosomal puffing days 3 through 6. Do those develop a profile and then narrow down so you're not looking at all the genes in the genome. You're just looking at a subset of ones that are in puffs. All right. So we've been talking about some of these structures with respect to mitosis and meiosis. Now we're actually going to talk about what they're made of and what their day-in, day-out function is. So centromere, one thing that they have in common between centromeres and telomeres is they're highly repetitive sequences. And by that, there's the same nucleotide sequence that's repeated multiple times in a row. They're not the same sequences, though, between centromeres and telomeres. Centromeres, there tend to be larger nucleotide sequences. With telomeres, we're really only looking at 6 nucleotides. That's just repeated and repeated. So here we've got CCC, TAA. Humans tend to have Gs in there. But there's a short sequence that's just repeated one after the other after the other. So in this example, and then you would have another CCC, TAA, and that would continue. And so just highly repetitive sequences at the telomere and at the centromere. At the centromere, then, there are specialized proteins that bind, and that allows the formation of the kinetic core and the centromere itself. Okay, so the centromere is the combination of the DNA sequences and the proteins bound. The kinetic core is the specific part of the centromere involved in chromosome separation. Okay. And telomere, let me see if we've got a good picture. Yeah, this is just showing a highly repetitive sequence. Just one after the other after the other. So when we talk about these, I mean, we're talking about thousands and thousands of base pairs of the same sequence over and over again. So centromeres, there are no genes expressed there, and it's more a matter of having sequences that are recognized by the centromere-specific proteins. So they could come in, bind. The centromere is actually a relatively large structure that forms, so you need a lot of those binding sequences for the proteins to come in and bind to it. The telomeres serve a different function. Okay? The telomeres, remember I mentioned really early in the semester that telomeres are kind of like aglets, the things that protect the ends of your shoelaces. Telomeres protect the ends of your chromosome. And what happens, though, is you've got these sequences right at the end. On Tuesday, when we talk about replication, we'll talk about this a little bit more. But it's difficult to replicate DNA that's right at the very end of a chromosome. And so what tends to happen is when you replicate the DNA before cell division, that some of the DNA doesn't get replicated. And what typically happens is you lose one of those repeats from the telomere. So you can think about it. Whenever your cells divide, the telomeres on your chromosomes get slightly shorter. Okay? And that happens throughout your life. And usually there's not a dramatic effect, but what tends to happen now is we know that there are some genes encoding expression of like connective tissue that are near the telomeres. If the telomeres start getting too short, you start affecting the expression of those nearby genes. It doesn't happen until you're later in life, but things like, you don't make collagen as much. And so your chondrocytes in your joints aren't replacing slightly damaged cartilage that's in your joints, and so you get rickety and slow like me. Wrinkles are a result of that, that gaps that form under your skin, they're typically filled up by collagen. If your genes are, or your telomeres start getting too short, you don't produce the same amount of collagen that you used to. You also get fewer numbers of cells that are producing collagen. So I guess I won't limit it just to guys, but putting collagen on top of your skin does not do anything underneath your skin. Collagen is a big worm-shaped, it's like a gummy worm of a molecule. It doesn't get through your skin, but what happens is if you put collagen in, it sort of spackles over and makes your skin look a little smoother until it starts drying out and caking on your face, and then you start to smell like Jell-O that's gone bad. Putting collagen on the outside doesn't do diddly squat for filling in wrinkles from the inside. The materials that tend to smooth out wrinkles tend to be inflammatory molecules. So if you get inflammation, if you've got swelling, your skin looks nice and tight in the area that's swelled, right? Because you've got extra water in there, it's puffing up. So most of the cosmetics that take wrinkles out around the eyes are slightly inflammatory molecules that cause a recruitment of blood flow to the area, it causes it to puff up. So there's a lot of really bad science that takes place in cosmetic commercials. Sometimes just listen, because they try to make it sound as technical as they can. Oh, it's got alpha hydroxy. That means alcohol. It's got alcohol in it. You're putting rubbing alcohol, and they're trying to make it sound more impressive. It will clean your skin, but it's going to dry it out. And then when they talk about peptides and amino acids, okay, it just means it's got some protein in it. And most people don't see through that. So sometime when you're up and you see, you know, one of the celebrities that has a 30-minute infomercial on makeup, just listen to the pseudoscience that's going in there. Your skin's a really nice barrier, and cosmetics tend not to get through it unless they are using really small molecules. Anyway, so you're going to get wrinkly. Okay, and your knees are going to ache at some point in time because your telomeres shorten. You guys remember Dolly the sheep that they cloned? So the way that they cloned Dolly was they took DNA from an adult sheep, they took a sheep egg, and then they just injected the adult DNA into the egg so that it was the egg was now two in, but it was all Dolly's DNA. It wasn't half Dolly and half a male sheep. It was just all Dolly DNA. They injected that into the egg, and then they implanted the egg, and then let another sheep give birth to an exact genetic replica of Dolly. The problem that, I mean, and Dolly was a genetic duplicate of the original DNA donor. The problem is clone Dolly started having joint issues really early in life. Dolly was old when she was relatively young by sheep standard because Dolly had shortened telomeres on her chromosomes, and so the gene expression early in life was expressing like an elderly sheep. Okay. So a lot of the syndromes that we associate with aging are just an accumulation of random mutations you get on your DNA during life. You spend time out in the sunlight, it dings up your DNA. Your mitochondria produce a lot of really harsh chemicals. Some of it gets out and damages your DNA. It's a sad fact of life. You live life, your DNA accumulates damage. So sometimes just the accumulation of those point mutations causes things not to work well. But a big driving force of aging is telomere shortening. So there are a lot of money by private companies looking into this because there's an enzyme that is typically functional in normal eggs as they develop called telomerase. And telomerase lengthens telomeres. So it goes and it puts on like 40 copies of that sequence at one time. And it re-lengthens them. And so, and part of that is if a woman is making eggs later in life, or if a guy's making sperm, it happens too in spermatogenesis. If his cells have shortened telomeres, you don't want a baby born with shortened telomeres, so you want long telomeres. So telomerase kicks in, adds on a bunch of copies of the repetitive sequence so that the newborn baby's got long telomeres and they'll be able to live 60 years before it's tough to get up off the couch. So there's a human telomerase gene that's out there that functions under very specific conditions, and people are spending a lot of money to get it to where they can manipulate the expression. And so there were studies done in mice that they have mice that have progeria. We had a flyby picture on one of the slides of a kid that it's a relatively young person, looked like they're about 80. It's that rapid aging disease. Very few people get it, but there's a progeria model in mice. And so they thought if they had a mouse progeria model, they cloned in an expression system in front of the telomerase gene that they could control. They thought if they turned the telomerase gene on, that they would get the mice, they let the mice age prematurely. They thought if they turned it on, they could then see the mice, they would just age normally from that point on. They did the experiment, they turned on the telomerase gene, and 3 days later they had mice that you could not distinguish from young mice that did not have progeria. So not only did they stop the rapid aging, they reversed aging in mice. So this is about 6-7 months ago. So get ready for those makeup ads now with telomerase. But my guess is sometime in your lifetime, someone in a private company, probably in another country first, will allow relatively wealthy people to come in and have their telomerase gene induced and see what happens. Here's the bad side of that. One of the nice functions that telomere shortening deals with is if you have cancer, you have a rapidly dividing line of cells inside of your body. And one of the things that limits how many times they can divide is telomere shortening. Telomere shortening is a defense against cancer. And so what's tended to happen in human cell lines when they play around with telomerase is you develop tumor cell lines at a much higher cell rate. So you may look wonderful when you're 85, except for that ginormous growth coming off the side of your neck. So it's just this cancer, just a little side effect that they got to work out yet before you can look marvelous. But my guess is whenever they get it close, Meg Ryan's first in line to try it out. So, I mean, she got nowhere to go but up at this point. So, yep, she's dating John Mellencamp now, isn't she, or something bizarre like that. Yep. Also, what they do first is you have these micro-manipulating pipettes, and they suck out the original DNA first, and then they use the same type of needle and they inject in the adult. So it's actually pretty easy to clone animals, but you've got that problem of the old DNA. There's companies that if you know you've got a dog that you love, you can clone your dog. It won't behave the same way. There's no guarantee that it's, you know, still going to wag its tail and love you, and as opposed to go for your throat. But it will look just like your original dog. That scientists move DNA in and out of large eggs. The only problem is by the time that the original egg had developed, it had already done the telomerase thing to lengthen the telomeres. So if they could do that and manipulate the egg to reinduce the telomerase, then you could put old DNA in and it would make it young, fresh DNA, and Dolly would have, you know, been able to jump fences like when you can't get to sleep. So, yeah, if you clone a baby animal, then you would have shorter telomeres. But then you take a chance that it could be a really obnoxious baby animal that you've just made more of. So it tends to take time before you realize, okay, this is a good one that we want to make more of. So that's the only problem with that. You can do the crapshoot and clone 50 different ones, get the fertilized egg, put it in suspended animation, watch the regular ones to see which one you like, throw the other 49 away, and then start mass producing that one because it's got really nice steaks. It's coming your way. So sorry that the beef industry will probably do that first. So, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. All right, so that's telomeres. We'll talk about this when we do replication. That you need to, when you're trying to replicate the ends, that those repetitive sequences are useful for clamping down the end during replication, but we'll talk about the specific mechanisms. Here's one of our sample questions. Neutralizing the positive charges would have what effect on histone proteins? Hopefully you got this, that they would separate from DNA. That the histones are bound to DNA by those opposite charges. DNA is negatively charged, histones are positively charged. So when we start talking about DNA modification and expression, one of the ways that we'll undo all of this compaction is we'll come in and either change the charge locally on DNA or change the charge on the histones. And if you change the charge of one of them, the other one doesn't like it and they dissociate. Okay? So by neutralizing the positive charge on histones, you can get the histones to release from DNA. All right. So the other day when we were talking about DNA structure, hopefully you all understand the idea of complementation, that depending on what base you have on one strand, you will always have its complement on the other strand under normal conditions. If you've got an A on this strand, you've got a T across from it. If you've got a G, you've got a C across from it. And if you're looking at, and remember, G's and C's make three bonds, A's and T's make two hydrogen bonds. Okay, but when we refer to complementary base pairs, that's what I mean, G's with C's, A's with T's. You can determine the composition of DNA by its melting temperature. And the melting temperature just means how warm you need to get it for those two strands to separate. You're not coming in and breaking the phosphodiester bonds. The hydrogen bonds holding the bases together are much easier to disrupt. So we're just going to take the two strands and we're going to unzip them. And you can do that by putting the DNA under high temperature conditions. And if you've got DNA of a known length, okay, so if you take 1,000 base pairs of DNA and you can do a put them on a like a spec 20, use spectrophotometric analysis to determine when they've all denatured. Based on that temperature, you could determine the GC content. Because the more GCs it has, the more hydrogen bonds need to be broken, so the more energy needs to go into it. So the more GCs, the higher the melting temp. And biologically, that's important, especially in microbiology, that there are bacteria that live near volcanic vents in the ocean. They're microorganisms that live in the hot springs, you know, in the Norris hot springs at Yellowstone. So they live in basically boiling water. Those organisms have very high GC content in their DNA. And that's just to keep their strands of DNA together in that warm environment. And there are also organisms that live in very cold conditions. There are bacteria that live meters underneath the ice caps at the poles that are replicating. And they replicate. It's a very long replication cycle. It takes years for the cells to divide. But their DNA is extensively A and T because they want it to take as little energy as possible to unzip those DNA strands. And so G's and C's tend to have a clamping effect. A's and T's are more relaxed, more flexible. So when we start talking about gene expression and next week and beyond, one of the things that we'll see is long stretches of A's or T's are areas where you can start to pull strands of DNA apart much easier. So if we need to separate strands of DNA, there'll typically be A's and T's in there that allow us to do it. It's much tougher to come in and pry apart G's and C's. But then if you separate the strands of DNA, if you let that solution cool down just a little bit, the two strands of DNA will come back together. We refer to that as renaturation or reannealing, and they will do so to form all of these complements. That's their optimal position. So you can separate them, and they will reanneal back with their complement right across the street again. Okay? And you could keep doing that all day, as long as the DNA molecule doesn't degrade, that there's not an enzyme in there. You can keep denaturing, renaturing DNA molecules, and they will snap back together in that original configuration all the time. Okay, it's the optimal kinetic form for it. All right. Now on the chromosomes, we've talked about some repetitive sequences that are present at the telomeres and at the centromeres. A lot of the important things that we'll talk about in gene expression were genes are unique sequences, where you will find them once or a small number of times within the entire genome of the organism. So the genome just means the collection of all the DNA. Okay, so the chromosomes, if we're talking about a bacteria, the plasmids are included in the genome as well. So there are some highly repetitive sequences, and there are others that are very infrequent. But so you could have a gene that's present only one time in the genome, or so it'd be on one chromosome in a diploid organism. You'd have two copies of it, okay, one on each homologue. And so that would be the hallmark of being a unique sequence. But there's something called gene families. And gene families are groups of very similar genes. They're not identical, but, you know, very, very similar. So, you know, like 90, 95% identity at the sequence level, but some variation. The day that we were talking about duplication, I said that if you duplicate a gene, then you can get mutation in one, and eventually you may have a gene that's got a slightly different function, like a glucosyl transferase or a galactosyl transferase. Those two genes would be about 90% identical. So they're not strictly a unique sequence, but we would lump them into a gene family, that they probably arose from a common gene through duplications. Okay? So technically unique should be a one-off, but in genetics we allow gene families to reside under the unique DNA sequence. Really what I want you to understand is that we've got repetitive and then we've got unique. So unique just means something that's not repetitive that you find multiple times, dozens of times to thousands of times throughout the genome. Okay. Then repetitive, we've already talked about repeats at the telomeres and the centromeres, but throughout your genome, there are highly repetitive areas of DNA that just take up space. And way back when they first did the human genome sequence, they realize that there's about 15% of your DNA comprises unique DNA. And the rest comprises largely repetitive sequences, but also some unique DNA that doesn't look like it's expressed. So they lumped all of this together, used to call it garbage DNA. We now know that a lot of this garbage DNA has really important functions. But the thing is, only about 10 to 15% of your DNA in your chromosomes represents the genes that are expressed in terms of making a protein. The vast majority of your chromosome isn't, and much of it is repetitive DNA. And they could either be tandem repeats, which just means one right after the other, right after the other, or you could have a relatively large sequence of like 1,000 base pairs, and then a little bit down the road on the chromosome, you see that exact sequence of 1,000 base pairs again. It's not one right after the other, but it's the same sequence represented multiple times in the chromosome. Some of them are relatively short, like an ALU repeat. ALU repeats are short sequences, but about 1% of your genome is ALU repeats. Doesn't do anything of great importance, but it's just this repetitive element. And so you can get highly repetitive sequences that are less than 10 base pairs long, where they just go one right after the other, right after the other. Evolutionarily, one of the thoughts behind why you've got that DNA is, remember, in eukaryotes, the individual matters. Right? Protecting you until your kids reach the age of reproductive maturity is important. Okay? And so I mentioned that we live in a relatively harsh environment in terms of DNA damage, and mutations can cause cancer, mutations can... if it's a severe mutation, can cause a more immediate problem. If you've got padding in your chromosomes, you've got extraneous DNA, so 85% of the DNA in your chromosomes doesn't encode a protein, there's only a 15% chance that a random mutation will take place in a sequence that encodes a protein. Remember, bacteria chromosomes are very compact. There's no extraneous DNA. They've got very small gaps between the genes. If there's a random mutation in a bacterial genome, it's about 96% likely that that mutation will be in a sequence that encodes a protein. But there are a billion cells just like that one next door if this one dies. So one of the evolutionary theories behind why eukaryotes tend to get larger, more complicated genomes, why prokaryotes get smaller, is the more padding you have in your chromosome, the less likely it is that you take a lethal hit from a random mutation. But that comes at the cost of you've got all this extra DNA that you've got to replicate. That takes a lot of energy. So it's buying into this, you know, cycle or spiral of eukaryotes are more complex, they take more energy to get them to maturity, they don't reproduce as quickly. Okay, so you're running with that model as a life system, and your genomes are getting bigger and more complicated. You've got 1,000 times more DNA than E. coli. You've got 8 times more genes. So you've got a lot of extraneous DNA that bacteria don't have that you're carrying around. Okay, so that's evolutionarily, that's why we think there's some of this repetitive sequence. There's also some special sequences within there that complicate things. They're referred to as transposable elements. It's a phrase that's worth a few of your brain cells to commit to memory. Where'd Blue go? You're my boy, Blue. All right. A really basic way to think about, I mean, you hear this phrase, this little catchphrase that they're jumping genes. You've not lived until you've heard a Swedish scientist say that phrase multiple times in a seminar. It's yuppin' genes. But they are sequences of DNA that have the ability to encode their own transposition. So they can move from one spot in the genome of a cell to another spot. And they do so by the action of proteins that are produced on that fragment of DNA. So in many senses, a transposable element is like a virus that never needs that protein shell to move from cell to cell. It just keeps introducing itself into the chromosome of the cell it's already in. It doesn't have to go outside and play. It's got a lot of room in the genome of its host. Let me see if we've got a... Okay, and there are some hallmarks of what you'll see on a transposable element. They tend to have names that start out with something like TN. For transposon, that They have flanking direct repeats. Let's see if we show what they're doing here. Okay. So flanking direct repeats at the ends. So here we've got TGCAA, TGCAA at the ends. And just inside of that, inverted repeats. Okay. And the thing about inverted repeats that we see here, that these will align. Let's see if we got the next one. Nope. These would align to form a stem in a stem loop structure. Okay. So we've got the flanking direct repeats on the ends. And then we've got the inverted repeats just inside of that. What will happen is the inverted repeats will line up with each other. Now, enough room up. We'll go down this time. Sorry, this looks really bad. I'll change the shape down here so people are not so easily offended. Okay, so we've got the inverted repeats will form a stem structure. So now we've brought these two regions of the transposon close together. Okay, for this thing, transposons can do one of two tricks. They can either replicate themselves, kind of like a copy and paste, where the original's not changed at all, or they could do a cut and paste. And so if you're doing a cut and paste, you need to excise this original sequence for it to move. And so one of the ways that you do it is bring the ends together, and then you cleave it, and now this can go and insert someplace in the chromosome. Right? So what happens with transposable elements is they move from one location to another in the chromosome. Some cases, when they do the copy and paste, you're increasing the number of transposons in the genome. With the ones that do the cut and paste, the number stays the same, but the location changes. And they insert at, they've got preferred sequences, but it's called semi-random insertion. And if you've got an important gene and a transposable element inserts in it, you've got a problem. Okay? And so some cases of cancers are linked to transposable elements. You've got these sequences that are bouncing around inside of your chromosome. There are, we're not going to talk about this mechanism, sorry. So there are some organisms that have huge numbers of transposable elements. About 10% of the human genome is transposable elements that are present in multiple copies. Okay? I worked with next door for several years to a parasitologist. His name's Dave Williams. He's up at Rush now. He worked on schistosomes, which are a worm that causes liver disease in third world countries. And schistosomes, Dave was part of the genome sequencing project on schistosomes, and it was almost an impossible project because there were so many transposable elements, so many copies of the same transposable element in schistosomes, that once they got all these sequences, they had trouble lining them up because 60% of the genome was transposable elements that lined up with every other transposable element. So some organisms have a huge frequency of transposable elements. Others, not so much, but that's part of that repetitive sequence on a chromosome. Remember the uniques, those tend to be genes. Repetitive can take a lot of forms. Transposons are one of them. One of the examples, let me see if we got here. No, the one that's typically given is Indian corn. Right? So it's that time of year where you see Indian corn out if you go to the pumpkin farms and stuff. Transposable elements affect which kernels are what color. And there's another example, which is grapes. So let me kill the lights. Purple or black grapes, white grapes or the green ones, and then the reddish ones are the same organism. And the only difference that they have is the relative status of a transposable element in the gene for the production of the black or purple pigment, the anthocyanin pigment. So here we've got the black or purple grape. and we just have the normal functional gene. So it's cranking out the black pigment, and so you get the black or purple grapes. In white grapes, what happens is there's a transposable element that comes in and it inserts itself between the promoter of the gene, so the place at which expression would start, and the pigment gene itself. And the presence of that transposable element, it's large enough that it completely prevents expression of that gene. So you don't get any of the purple pigment that's present. And it's that pigment that, and the way that it interacts with other molecules that sort of give black or purple grapes that kind of astringent bite to it, that they purple or black grapes taste a little bit more bitter than the yellow the green or the white ones. But then we've got these red ones that are partway in between. What happens with them is this is a cut and paste type of transposon. And so this middle part, the orange part, when it removes itself, it takes the orange part and leaves this pink to purple part behind. So when this transposable element jumps, it leaves this sequence behind. And so now we've got this relatively short sequence that's left between the promoter and the encoding region of that gene. It doesn't stop it completely like it does in the white grapes. It allows it to be expressed, but it's expressed at a lower level than it is in the purple or the black grapes. So when you go to Meijer or Kroger, wherever you go, and you look at the three grapes, there's repetitive transposable elements that determine what your grape looks like and what it tastes like because of this one gene and the transposition events just upstream of that gene. All right, then real quickly, just one of the things that I want to point out is the other day when we were talking about chromosomal rearrangements, and we were talking about inversions or deletions, it requires sequences that line up at different parts of the chromosome. So we're not talking about, the lining up that takes place during tetrad formation. But if you've got repetitive sequences in the genome, and here it's denoted by these yellow sequences, if you've got the transposons in this case that are on the same chromosome, those sequences will line up with each other. So you can get a looping event so that they line up. And so that sets up a situation in which you can get a deletion. If you have transposable elements that are direct repeats of each other, that sets the stage where you can delete this segment of the chromosome in between. So here we had one here between B and C. Here's one between E and F after they loop. And during replication, it tries to resolve this by just going through. It gets to C, and it's like, I can't get through that loop. I'm just going to go this way. You lose the segments between this transposon and this transposon. So we lose C through E. So transposable elements on the same chromosome in direct repeats increase the rate of deletions on that chromosome. If you've got them in inverted orientation, so here we've got one arrow going from left to right, the other one going from right to left, instead of forming a figure eight, if you ever had the Hot Wheel track, you always wanted the loop-to-loop, that you'd get it, go do the loop-to-loop, that's a deletion. Here we just have a horseshoe shape to line them up since they're going opposite directions. And then there's recombination that takes place, and that produces an inversion event. So transposable elements, direct repeats, deletion, transposable elements, and inverted repeat form on the same chromosome, inversions. And then the transpositions can take place as a result of transposable elements on the homologs, the two chromosomes involved, that are at different locations. So here we've got chromosomes that have these transposable elements. They bunch up. They bunch up differently. And then we wind up with a deletion and a duplication. So it gives the effect of a translocation when actually the DNA hasn't been moved from one to the other, but the combination of a deletion and duplication event mimics a translocation. So, okay. And then the last thing that we'll talk about with transposons, and I'll let you go, is the regulation of transposition. I told you that the genes involved in the transposon moving throughout the genome are present on the transposon itself. Okay. And what happens is when you get a new a cell that's a new host for a transposon, there tends to be a high rate of transposition. Right? That it's making copies of itself, jumping around a lot into the chromosome. But as the cell gets older and as cells get more and more copies of transposons in them, the rate of transposition drops dramatically. So it seems like biologically there's a selection towards a steady state, that there's an optimal amount of transposition that's actually beneficial or is the lowest level of detriment that a cell can have for a steady state. But early on, the thing jumps around a lot until it gets to a certain number of copies, and then it basically duplicates itself for everyone that's lost in a deletion event, and it maintains a static number of copies within a cell. And until a few years ago, we didn't understand why you just didn't see cells of older people with much more transposable elements in the genome. It's because they get to a certain point, and biologically, you hit a threshold through which it becomes detrimental to have more transposition events. Oh, okay, so there's homework online today, and it's just sort of a mishmash of a few things that we've covered in class that you will probably see on the test that I haven't hit on the previous homeworks. Again, it shouldn't take you 10 minutes to get it done, but it will be due on Tuesday.